a download from Triple J.
For more music, current affairs, comedy and culture, triplej.net.au.
And now...
Triple J
Mornings with Zan.
Zan here hanging out. It's Thursday morning. Good morning, Dr. Carl.
Good morning, Dr. Zan.
Happy Thursday to you. Happy winter.
Happy winter. It is getting coldish, but nothing like what they have in the European parts of the world.
I think we're pretty lucky in Australia. Have you been rugging up some more?
No, I haven't been just... I discovered a weird phenomenon. We've put a bathroom into our house, and it was a bath. We actually put a bath in a bathroom. And I discovered something I'd completely forgotten, that if you soak yourself in the bath for about half an hour, you're warm for a couple of hours after that.
I know.
I've forgotten about
warm
that.
Warm from the inside out. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I miss baths. We're talking science here at Triple J this morning. If you've got a question, now is the time to give us a buzz, 1-300-055-36. If you've got an answer or a comment, you can tweet directly at Dr. Carl and get straight through to him, D-O-C-T-O-R-K-A-R-L. But questions are all on the phone, and we're going to begin on this Thursday morning with...
With our
first
question.
Stretch over. Paul. We'll start with Paul from Thomastown. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. What's your question?
I was watching the Stephen Hawking special the other night about time travel. And my question is that he said that basically, correct me if I'm wrong, but the laws of the universe are all governed by the speed of light, that nothing can exceed the speed of light.
Within the universe... Nothing can exceed the speed of light, but when the universe itself was expanding in the early days,
yes,
it could expand at faster than the speed of light.
Ah.
So therefore, the age of the universe is 13.7 whatever it is billion years old, the radius of the universe is about 40 something billion light years.
Well, sparking off on that, it said that if we were to build like a spaceship or something, that we cannot make something to exceed that speed. Now, if that's the case, if there were, you know, in a simple equation, if you and I were in space, moving apart from each other at 1 meter a minute, who's to say that who's moving and who isn't? And then, if that's the case, if there was a spaceship hurtling at the speed of light, who's to say that everything else isn't moving at the speed of light and his spaceship is not sitting still?
That's tricky. The whole point of relativity, who has relative motion, and it began, this field of thinking about relative motions, with, we think, Galileo, who was in a ship in a harbour and he was underneath the decks. And it was a very calm day.
Yep.
And then suddenly he thought, the ship should be moving, but I can't tell if it's moving or not. And then he thought a little bit more, and rather than rush upstairs and say, well, is the ship moving or not, he thought, hang on, there's no difference between moving at a constant velocity and being dead still. And there's not. And this is part of the equivalence thing. And look it up on our good friend Wiki, or Wikipedia, as it's properly named. And the way you can tell a difference is acceleration. So the moment you get pushed around, you're being accelerated or decelerated. But with regard to an absolute still spot in the universe, there ain't no such thing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Although I should ask my clever friends in physics about whether you can use a cosmic radiation background as a reference point, but that's another story. So I don't have anything else to say except thank you for watching
it. So if you're at a constant speed, at the speed of light, in a way, you are at a constant still, so...
Oh, hang on. Then when we had the mind mill with the clever guys, they said the speed of light is only a local phenomenon, so I think we should just stop it there because we don't have a relativist here like the clever guys who are Kip Thorne
and... Big questions.
Who was the other guy? Penrose.
Penrose,
yeah. We need them back again next time.
Thanks so much for the call,
Paul. Thank you,
Paul,
for getting us thinking on an elevated plane. Nothing to do with groins or anything. Very good start to the show.
We have Nathan on the line from Gladstone this morning. Hi, Nathan.
Morning, Dr. Zan. Morning, Dr. Carl.
Dr. Nathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Just a quick question, Dr. Carl. I was very sick about 3-4 weeks ago. I developed a chest infection. I noticed after getting up in the morning and having like a rather large coughing fit, I noticed I was seeing little like light spots in both eyes, open and closed. Sort of appearing and then disappearing in different spots.
Were they coming with the coughing?
Just afterwards, like I could feel the sort of extra pressure inside my head. So I was just wondering if that's to do with the blood pressure and the vessels in your eyes.
And did the coffee? Did the coloured lights go away as the you returned back to normal?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, eventually, probably looking 30 to 45 seconds after I finished coughing.
Oh, for a minute, I thought you were going to say 40 to 35 minutes. No, that's okay. Now, what happens is that light lands in your eyeball on cells in the retina called rods or cones, and inside there are molecules called rhodopsins, and there's 11 cis and 11 trans. The point is that the light lands on these molecules, and the molecules are so delicately balanced that even a light, even a photon, will unhinge them. They'll change shape and give off electricity, and then you get the impression of light. So you get the impression of light when either when the molecule changes shape. It can change shape either because a photon of light landed on it or because you had a pressure wave going through your eyeball.
So, oh, okay. And that would explain the moving as well?
So you got that pressure effect. And so long as it's not a good thing to have. If you've got that sort of phenomenon happening in your eyeballs, you don't want to have that happening all day because you're heading for brain damage. But associated with a coughing fit fading away immediately afterwards, okay, you can live with it. But so what you were doing was stimulating 11, I think it was 11 cis retinal, and as it changed shape, it would then give off the electricity, which gives you the impression of light 0.3 of a second later in the Brodmann's areas 18 and 19 to the back of your head.
Hey, thanks for the call, Nathan.
Thank you, Dr.
Very
Nathan.
Much,
see you later. Meg's calling in from Radelaide this morning. Hi, Meg.
Howdy.
Hi,
Dr.
Meg.
What's your question?
I'm just wondering, we have a gaming system which involves a sensor bar. Recently the sensor bar stopped working and we were told that if we put two tea light candles in front of the TV, as long as you got two, the remote would work. It worked.
Wow.
I want to know, how does it work?
Two tea light candles in front of the telly.
Hang on, what's this gaming system? Is this a gambling thing?
No. It's
like,
Meg
like,
just doesn't want to use
the... want to say the brand.
Yeah, the brand. Oh, yeah. So it's like a video game.
It's a video game thing where you move your body around. Okay.
Yeah, and you need a remote control to make this particular one work.
Yep.
It has a sensor bar. The sensor bar is broken.
Uh-huh.
And I was told that if I use two tea light candles, as long as I use two, it would make the infrared work. And it actually works.
Okay, second question. What's a tea light candle, Mummy?
They're the
little candles.
Little candles.
Little cute ones.
That are in little steel containers. You can buy them in packets of 100 at a $2 store.
And how long do they last for?
A few hours.
Okay, so you needed two of them to give a reference point so I could see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so it does work with infrared. And you can do this neat experiment where you can get a remote control and then turn it around so it's pointing at your face and aim it at your face. And then switch it on and you see nothing. And then put your phone camera in between you and your and it. And so you aim it at the phone camera.
Uh-huh.
And then suddenly you'll see the remote control light up because the sensor can pick up infrared. So what I'm trying to say is that infrared is a very common set of frequencies used by remote controls to talk to each other. So the candle, it didn't care about the light, it was caring about the heat. And so if you gave it fixed reference points, it could say, okay, this is point A, this is point B, I know where I'm standing, it's roughly near the TV, this is where the sensors are supposed to be. So you'd fooled it with old technology. So you managed to make some of the most sophisticated technology known to the human race in recent times available to consumers work with a couple of cheapo candles going back a couple of 100,000 years.
Yeah.
Human spirit wins again.
Good work, Meg. Thanks so much for the call.
Excellent. Thank you.
See you later. We're talking science with Dr. Carl. Got a question? Give us a call, 1300 055 36. Talking science with Dr. Carl, 1300 055 36. If you've got a question for us, here till midday. Ben in Townsville does. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, doctors.
Thanks for staying on the line. What's your question?
My question is about chickens and how the chicken makes the hard outside of the shell. In its body.
Ah,
good question.
Now, luckily, I'd written a story on this in Q&A with Dr. K, book number 20 or something, a long time ago. Now, the egg is a self-contained environment that it beautifully protects life from its very earliest moments. And they let life come onto the land. So eggs of fish, well, you squirt them out into the surrounding water. Amphibians, they can survive out of water. They still need a moist environment. Reptiles, they have a sort of a leathery egg. And for the birds to survive with their calcium-based eggs on eggshells, they took another 150 million years to evolve. Now, the egg has got a bit of DNA, which will grow into a living creature, and a whole lot of food to protect it while and to nurture it while it's still inside the shell. With regard to the chicken, you have to give them the right ratio between light and dark, about 17 hours of light and 7 hours of dark, lots of protein, lots of fat, and then chickens will come into lay at around 22 weeks of age. When they're in one of these chicken egg factory thingy-wingies, they're laying almost one egg per day until they're killed 1 year later, about 72 weeks. They're running on a physiological tightrope that is so tight that they're practically in fatty liver disease. They're now machines that just turn food into eggs. So they've got massive amounts of fat in their abdomen, as well as a thing called fatty liver. And that counts as a disease. So that's what happened to the eggs that you mostly get. But talking about the egg getting its shell, they have only one ovary, and not two, the left ovary, and it squirts the egg out through the world to the outside world through a thing called an oviduct. And it goes through five stages, and it's in the fourth stage, or the fifth stage, the uterus or the shell gland, the fourth stage, is only 8.3 centimetres long, but the egg spends 19 hours out of its 24 hours there, and that's where the calcium is added. So it has to provide strength, but it has to have holes in it, between 7 and 17,000 holes, so it can react with the outside world, breathe oxygen, get rid of carbon dioxide, pick up water vapour, that sort of stuff.
So you're saying it's only towards the very end stage, just before it's about to be laid, that it actually gets hard?
It gets hard. So it's got five stages in the oviduct, which leads from its single uterus. It takes spending 24 hours in the whole system, and 19 of the hours are spent in the fourth stage where it gets the calcium added. In that second last stage. In the last stage, well, that doesn't really count. Well, it does. It's the vagina. It doesn't spend any time there. It just gets squirted out into the outside world.
Squirted out. There you go. Thanks so much for the call, Ben.
Thank you.
That's a great question. I've always wanted as well. So chickens who are living free range wouldn't have an average of one egg per day. They'd be taking a little bit longer.
They'd take a lot longer. They'd have less disease in their body. I mean, they've been turned into machines that turn food into eggs. Mm. It's a bit unfair, but then we eat eggs, but then it's unfair.
Yeah.
I can see both sides.
If you've ever seen an egg factory, it's pretty horrific. I think you're never going to eat any non-free-range eggs after that. Kyle's calling in from Newcastle. Hello, Kyle.
How you going, Zan? How you going, Dr. Kyle?
Dr. Kyle, welcome to the show.
Quick question about looking into a spoon.
Mm.
When you look into the concave bit of the spoon, you're upside down, and when you flip it around and look at the other side, you're at the right way up.
Yeah, you have to do a thing called a ray diagram where you follow the rays of light that leave the object. And so if they're leaving your chin, if you're looking at the inside, if you're looking at the inside, the concave side, the bit of the light that leaves your chin will then bounce on and then end up in your eyeball in such a way as to make it upside down. Look, it's really hard to say it without actually drawing the ray diagrams. If you go to our good friend Wikipedia, and look up the two words ray, R-A-Y, diagram, and concave, that will give you the perfect diagram. I can only do it with drawings. My verbal skills are not great enough, but at least I've got you started, Dr. Kyle.
Go forth, Kyle. Good luck. Thanks for the call.
Go there forth.
Thanks for that.
We've got Marcus on the line from Perth today. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, guys. Hi, doctors.
Hi, Dr. Marcus.
Look, I've got a really weird one for you. When I vividly remember my dreams, and it can be at any time during the following day, usually when I'm waiting for the bus, waiting for work, or walking through the supermarket, I get vertigo. And when I say vertigo, I've been told that I absolutely blanch in the face. My guts go to water. I sweat. I get clammy hands. And I really feel like I'm just going to pass out.
When you say you remember your dreams, at one extreme it'd be sort of, I was in the shop and then I walked through the door and then suddenly I was surfing on a volcano, or is it that you're right in there in the full reimagining of it as opposed to just describing the high points to a fellow human?
Yeah, so I tend to dream fairly vividly anyway, so I try and make myself remember them as soon as I wake up, but if I'm just standing around or someone starts talking about dreams and I'll go, oh, that reminds me of that dream last night, and I just go,
so you can't describe your dream going into it fully and then getting caught up in this vertigo? It's an engrossing...
Well, that's it. People say, tell me about your dream. I really don't like doing it because I tend to just get completely
Okay. The first thing to realise is a philosophical point. When you're asleep, you're not dead to the world. You're not wasting time. The person who is Marcus, the other Marcus, is in a stream of consciousness that the wake Marcus has no idea about. I don't know what Dr. Carl does when he's asleep. I've got no idea. And so it's not as though you're dead to the world. You're in a different consciousness. Yeah. And dreams are a subset of that, but different. But they're a subset of it. So in your case, and we don't know why, when you bring back the idea, the memory, the experience, the feeling of the dream, you partially try to get through into that other consciousness. And during that consciousness, you are flat on your back, paralyzed, unable to move, and your body begins to take you part of the way down that pathway. Right. And that, I don't think I can do any more science in saying that that's where you go.
Okay, have you ever come across it before?
I've heard of it only once. Oh, most people don't go that far. It doesn't make you weird or abnormal. You're just more in touch with the other Marcus, whoever that other Marcus is. And if they know the lot of numbers for tomorrow, can you let us know?
You have special powers, Marcus.
Thanks
so much for the call, Marcus. Have a good day.
Thanks very much.
We've got Nick calling in from Young. Hello, Nick.
Hi, Dr. Nick. Welcome. How are you?
Can you hear us?
Yeah, are you there?
Hi.
Yeah.
What's your question?
Hey, doctors, how are you?
Great.
Good.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, when you're about to have a shower and that, if you go to the toilet and do a wee and then you hop in the shower, you need to wee again? Just wondering what that's from.
I was bothered about that this morning. And a straight answer is, I don't know. And if somebody can ring in and give us a peer-reviewed paper or on our good friend Twitter, D-O-C-T-O-R-K-A-R-L, I've often wanted to know that, Nick, and I don't know, and I want to know. And with a bit of luck, we'll have the answer by the end of the show because we did find out about whether insects have pain or not, and we did get the answer to that.
People help us. Isn't there something about hearing, you know, just like when you run a tap, if you slightly need to go to the toilet, all of a sudden you really need to go to the toilet because the sound of dripping water?
But why? Yeah. Why does it make you want to go instead of make you not want to go?
Or why does it not make you thirsty? Because that's
why does it make you thirsty?
Yeah, it's interesting. All right, we'll see if we can get an answer for you before the morning's out. Thanks for the call, Nick.
Thank you, Dr. Nick.
Worries. See you later.
Bye.
We're talking science with Dr. Carl. 1-300-055-36. If you've got a question, if you've got an answer, hit us up on Twitter or 0439 757 555. 0439 757 555, the text line number. Dr. Carl's joining us as he does every Thursday here at Triple J, answering your science questions. Cozzy's calling in from Richmond. Hi, Cozzy.
Hi, guys. How's it going? Good day, Dr. Carl. Dr. Z.
Cozzy, welcome.
Dr. Cozzy, what's your question?
Just a quick one there regarding desalination plants, because we're building one here in Adelaide. And I spoke to a plumber recently and who had worked up in Queensland. I think they've got a couple up there, apparently.
Yeah.
He was telling me a couple of facts that the coastline is going to be full of salt. There's not going to be anything living along there. And your pipes and everything else with your water heater and your water pipes are going to rust out after a couple of years, every 2-3 years. Is that correct?
What they do is they get a whole bunch of ocean water in there. They extract the salt. They then split the salt one way and the fresh water the other way. Don't ask how. And so you get fresh water without any salt going into the water system. So it should not have any effect on your pipes. It should not. And that means that the water going back into the ocean is more salty. And that will affect the creatures there. So the surrounding bubble of ocean that is affected depends upon how much extra hypersalty water you chuck back in. And I don't know whether it's a kilometre, 100 metres. If somebody could give us an answer to that, that would be lovely to know.
That's unbelievable. But if that's a fact, I mean, that's just crazy.
On the other hand, we do muck up the world. We do disturb the universe. We've finally got to the stage now where we humans shift more dirt than nature shifts.
Wow.
Each year, erosion shifts roughly 10 billion tons of dirt from mountains down into the ocean, and we shift something like 7 billion tons of coal, 2.5 billion tons of iron, and the same again in what's called charmingly overburden, which means the rainforest that happens to be on top of the coal that you want to get at. So for the first time, we humans are now causing more physical effects to the planet than nature itself does, which is not bad for a bunch of human beings that, if you got them all together, could fit inside a box 1 kilometre on a side. It's an amazing thing that we can do. It's perhaps we're not a bit immoderate in what we do and where we do it. But the ocean, if somebody can tell us how big the bubble of hypersaltiness is and what the effects are on the local sea creatures, we'd love to hear.
Hey, thanks for the call, Cozzy.
Thank you, Dr. Cozzy.
We've got Aaron from Geraldton on the line. Aaron, you've been busy creating things in your backyard. What have you been up to?
A couple of years ago. Actually, I still do it now. But we're working in a town in Tavannes. It's halfway between Geraldton and Perth.
Mm-hmm.
And we live in Perth, or we live in Geraldton. And Triple J was not showing live there. So in Tavannes, the place we're working. So we rigged up a massive antenna, right? And in the morning, we picked up Triple J from Geraldton. Then from lunchtime, we got nothing. But in the afternoon, we could get reception from Perth.
How big was this antenna?
It was very big, actually. It was 80 metres long and it was 20 metres high.
20 metres high?
Yeah.
And 80 metres long?
Yeah.
So you got, is that a quarter wavelength or something?
No.
But, okay.
It was, yeah.
But nevertheless, it worked in the morning?
Yep.
But not in the afternoon?
Yeah.
I don't have a good answer for that, but I'll try and work from first principles. One last question. What was the distance between you and where the signal was being broadcast? How many kilometres?
From Savannah or Geraldton.
Yeah.
It was 220
k's. Okay, 220 k's. Now, the line of sight of FM is probably maybe 80 k's. It curves around the horizon a little bit, but not much. So almost certainly you are bouncing off the layers above the ground. There are different layers there. There's a heavy side layer, overside layer, the ionosphere. There's a whole bunch of layers, and they shift up and down during the day. And if you're using HF radio, which used to be the stuff you used in the outback, you'd start with a low frequency in the morning and work your way up to the higher frequencies as the layer kept on climbing due to the heat of the day. And you could get best reception at the end of the day because the layer was higher and acted as a bigger mirror. It was higher and you could reflect further. So what I'm thinking is that you, as the mirror lifted higher, were in a null zone. It was at the right height in the morning, and then if you'd been further away, if you'd shifted another 50 kilometres down the road, you might have been able to pick it up. Now, I'm not an expert in this field of radio transmission, but if somebody could give... That's got to start. And if somebody can give an answer, that will get you more of an answer later in the show, Dr. Aaron.
We'll see if we can find out more for you, Aaron. Thanks so much for the call.
Right. No worries.
See you later. Paul's calling in from Wollongong. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Dr. Paul. Welcome
to
the show.
What's your question?
Just a follow-on from the first question. With the speed of light, we know that it's got a maximum limit. But does it accelerate to that limit?
It's either at that speed or not. So I was taught this by a very clever person in physics, and I'll pass this message on to you. Here it comes. Be ready. Pay attention. When it is travelling, light is a wave, full stop. When it is being born or when it dies, it is a particle. So when light is being absorbed by something or being radiated by a light bulb, at that instant, as it is interacting with the surface, it's a photon. The moment it leaves the surface and starts travelling through air, vacuum, space, whatever, it is a wave. I can't answer how it gets from zero up to full speed. That's beyond my ability. That is too deep for me, Dr. Paul. We would like an answer on that too as well on the Twitter, if somebody could come in.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Cass is on the line from wonderful Kyneton in Victoria with one of the most random questions we've had in a while. Hi, Cass.
Hello.
Hi,
Cass. Doctors. How are you?
Great. What's your question?
Well, my question's about making horses pee. We whistle at the races, at home, at pony clubs. You whistle to make them wee, especially the boys.
Hang on. Tell me more about this phenomenon. How do you know this? Have you actually done it? Tell me more.
You wave or you whistle and give it about 35, 40 seconds and they'll stand back and let it all go.
Wow.
Hang on. Any sort of horse, a racehorse, a workhorse?
I do it to my pony at home, but mainly racehorses I do in the mornings. But, yeah, at the racetrack they've got a swab box that you've got a limited time to get them to wee and you can make them wee.
Hang on. What sort of whistle? Give me a demonstration of the whistle.
Oh, give it a go.
And for how long do you have to do that whistle?
You just keep it up and then they start peeing and you can get to stop whistling.
And does it take like 10 seconds, a minute, an hour?
Oh, a minute at the most.
You're kidding me.
No, I'm not kidding you.
Question to Zan, have you ever heard of this?
No.
No.
That's why I'm intrigued.
So you can make
behind
a
behind all the big boxes at the races.
You're kidding.
And yeah.
You learn something every day.
I mean, is it Pavlov's syndrome? Is it just training from a young age?
It's bad for them to run on a full belly. So you get them to wee before they go for a big run.
But I'm wondering if horses in the wild do this or if it is a trained thing for horses that are kept in, you know, captivity, racehorses and stuff.
For example, would it be that when you're training a horse, every time that you notice that the horse is weeing, does the lowly paid whistler immediately start whistling so that it's linked in their brain that weeing and whistling go together? Or
I've never done that with any of the babies that I've worked with.
So if you get a baby,
baby racehorses.
So it's not Pavlovian conditioning.
Yeah, no, we never do that. It's the races that just gets thrust upon them, some of them.
So this means when you're at a horse race, behind the scenes, before each horse gets into his little box at the barrier, somebody behind the scenes has been going, okay, time for me to make this horse have a wee.
And they start... Amongst other things, yeah.
You're kidding.
So your original question, Cass, was can you actually make people wee by whistling?
Yeah.
But we're trying to get our heads around making horses wee by whistling, so I'm not sure whether we can help you.
Well, hang on.
Yeah, we've had that joke at work that you can make people wee by making that same whistle.
Because we were talking about why this... Oh, is there a relationship between the sound of the whistle and the sound of the water?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, this is getting deep.
I can actually hear water in the background of wherever Cass is, and that's kind of, I'm sure, making people want to go to the toilet quite possibly.
Okay, so have you been able, you and your naughty fellow horse whistlers, been able to make people, you know, at a party, you're a bit bored, make them so say, oh, I've got to go to the toilet now because you've been whistling for a minute or so?
Oh, if one of us need to go to the toilet and we're not quite back on the horses, yeah, people give us hell. And it seems like it does make it a bit worse. I haven't had it done to myself, but I've done it to other people, and it does make it seem rather uncomfortable for them.
So you're saying that you've whistled and people have needed to go to the toilet after you whistling?
Yeah, but they've said beforehand that they've needed to go as well, so I can't say for sure that it is.
Somebody
we need a control group.
Well, I can smell an ignoble prize here. Now, somebody has tweeted in saying it's an encouraged response, like a dog sitting on command. So it's not a conditioned response, it's encouraged. So presumably you whistle, and what they're implying is that somebody whistles, the horse tries a bunch of things, and when it starts weeing, you say, good horse, good horse, good horse. Do you do that?
We don't say good horse, but we certainly stop whistling, which could be taken as good horse.
Okay, so I hadn't heard of this encouraged response, but it fits in with the dog sitting on command.
I'd love to hear from...
We need to know more.
You know, I don't know, maybe another horse trainer or something like that. We'll see if we can find out and get to the bottom of it, Cass. Thanks for the call.
Thank you very much.
Right.
Have a good
afternoon. You too. Interesting stuff, Dr. Carl. The things you learn.
I've never heard of horse weeing.
Neither have I. 1-300-055-36 if you've got a question. Dr. Carl joining us to talk science for the next 10-15 minutes here at Triple J, and we are talking horse whistling, horse weeing. Whole bunch of people on the text line saying, you city folk, no idea. It's an old bushy trick. Everybody knows that you whistle to make a horse wee. Louis in Ballarat is all over it. Louis, you've got some answers for us.
Well, I do. Look, it's a trained thing. When you see them pee, you whistle, and they condition to it. And one of the ways we do this is horses don't like, when they pee, they don't like it splashing up on their legs, which is why they stretch out in all weird and wonderful positions. So those boxes at the racetrack are filled with straw and soft bedding, so that they're inclined to pee on that, whereas the stalls that they're standing in are hard, and they don't like to pee on the hard concrete because they get splashed. So between the soft bedding that they're on and the whistling, which we condition them to, then they pee.
So the whistling does happen for horses that are probably in racing, definitely brought up in captivity, and it's something that they're taught when they're foals?
Yeah. Even if you don't realise, I mean, most people, they see a horse having to pee, you whistle. But it's more to do with where they are at the time they're peeing. I mean, you can whistle a horse, if it's standing on concrete, it's going to be really uninclined to pee on that because it'll get its legs splashed. But pop it in and in a swab box with some nice soft bedding and give it a whistle, or, yeah, off it goes.
There you go. Thanks so much for the answer, Louis.
Thank you, Dr. Louis.
Good on you, mate. I've got another answer from something else we were talking about last break, about our friend in Geraldton who had assembled a giant antenna and could only pick up Triple J
from
in the mornings.
Hundreds of kilometres away.
And not the afternoons. David in Hobart is calling us about that. Good morning, David.
Good morning, how are you?
Great. What's the answer as to why this reception was only being picked up in the morning but not the afternoon?
Yeah, it's a phenomenon called tropospheric ducting. It's fairly well known in the antenna industry. I work for an antenna company and I'm in Tassie and sometimes in Launceston, if the weather's right, if the troposphere is in the right condition or right position, we can actually pick up TV from Melbourne. And it's the same with HF radio, as Dr. Carl was saying before. It's also the same with FM radio as well.
So when you say ducting, does that imply that there are two layers in the sky and that the signal goes in between those layers, is trapped and then gets carried for a while and comes down? Or is it just that it acts as a mirror?
That's exactly right. Yep, exactly right. So the troposphere and the ionosphere act like a duct, act like a funnel basically, and the signal will just bounce off those two areas until it gets to land, which is usually where the troposphere opens up a bit, and then it pops straight down onto your antenna and bang, you've got your reception.
Ah, because the story I heard when we were travelling through the Gibson Desert, that's when we were off-road for a month, and we carried 600 litres of fuel, and we finished up with 40. There were three people travelling in little tiny four-wheel drives, and they didn't take enough fuel, and so they end up shifting themselves from three into two into one, and then finally they ran out of fuel. They had a CB radio, which had a range of 20 kilometres, a CB radio. And this is in the top left-hand corner of Australia, up in the Western Australian deserts at the top end. They managed to bounce across on a thing called sideband to California.
Whoa.
They then managed to convince them that they were real. They had an aeroplane fly out and find them. And then they returned with a 44-gallon drum or 205-litre drum of petrol wrapped in a mattress. So what they do is they get this drum, they wrap it in a mattress and they tie it underneath the wing with rope, and then when they fly over them, they just reach out the window, cut the rope, and it just goes bounce, 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 and then charge them $10,000 for the delivery fee.
Well, sure.
But otherwise they would have died.
Antennas.
Antennas.
Amazing. Thanks so much for the answer, David.
Thank you, Dr.
David.
Good on you. See you later. We've got Mark calling in from Rocky this morning. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Dr. Dan, Dr. Carl.
Dr. Mark, welcome.
Hi. Look, I was just travelling the other day with my friend, and he's saying that he'd read that it was further to travel around Australia travelling clockwise than anti-clockwise because of the extra distance on the outside.
In Australia, we drive on the left, so assume that there's a multi-lane highway going around Australia, which there isn't. So if you were sticking on the extreme left, on the outside, you'd be travelling clockwise, so you travel a bigger distance. And if you're travelling anti-clockwise, or as the Americans call it, counterclockwise, you'd be on the... Hang on. I can't get my 3D geometry right, but yes, there is a very slight difference. Hang on, if you're on the outside of the circle, you're travelling clockwise, so that's a long... Can you work it out in your head, Zan?
No.
Neither can I. We're equally deficient in 2D, 3D geometry, but yes, there is a slight difference of 5 or 10 metres difference in travelling around Australia if you travel on the clockwise or counterclockwise or anti-clockwise.
But in terms of this question, it's a very minute difference,
yeah,
isn't
well,
it?
That's what I was saying, but he said it would be kilometres difference.
No, not kilometres.
No. All right. Thanks for the call, Mark.
Thank you.
All right.
I think we have time for one more.
Yes.
Brad's calling in from Terry Hills. Hi, Brad.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Great. What's your question?
Basically, I'm a 21-year-old Christian virgin, and I'm copping some grief from the boys at work, and it's because I don't masturbate. I've been going for like 2 months without doing it because the Bible says don't lust, and so I don't think you can masturbate without lusting. So I was wondering, is it unhealthy to not masturbate?
I don't think so. In the case of men getting a vasectomy, where the sperm can no longer get from the testicles to the outside world, in most cases, in the vast majority of cases, they just get reabsorbed, and you can get little granulomas and a few little minor problems. well, they wouldn't be minor, but they are, you can get problems. With yep. masturbation, I think you might just find yourself accidentally having a nocturnal sexual emission type dream, and it's not your fault because
like
you weren't
dreams.
There. You can blame that on unconscious Brad, the other one.
Yeah.
It's not your fault.
Yeah.
I don't think there's disadvantages. Now, there's a separate issue of what it does to your testosterone levels over time. And I remember reading an article about that. And to some degree, regular sex, sexual intercourse or activity does things to your testosterone levels, but I can't remember what the article said. I've forgotten. Gee, imagine me not knowing whether it's good or not to have sex regularly. In general, I think I follow the advice of Frank Zappa, who said there's two things you can't have too much of, vegetables and sex. But then that doesn't put any pressure on you because we respect whatever belief system you have.
Yeah.
Good luck, Brad.
Cool, thanks, guys.
Thanks for the call. I think we have time for one more quick one from Brent calling in from Hoppers Crossing. Hi, Brent.
Hi, Dr. Brent. Welcome.
Hi, how you going?
Great. Have you got a quick question for us?
Yeah, quick one. A friend of mine, he's got a phobia about eating new foods. Now, he's completely convinced that if he goes to a hypnotist, that a hypnotist will cure his phobia of new foods, and I think it's complete and utter rubbish. I was just wondering your thoughts and if it has any merit to his theory.
Can hypnotism cure phobias, Carl?
Some people are hypnotisable and some are not. Both Adam Spencer and myself are not. Other people are. And for some of the people who are hypnotizable, hypnosis can help. It can help remove addiction to smoking, and it can help in, for example, the phobia of new foods. But it's a variable thing. It is not 100% reliable, such as that opiates will remove pain, as they do in 99.9999% of the population. It's a soft thing, and it might work for your friend. But on the other hand, it might not. You can't say that whether it's crap or not based on this. And I forget. And the Scientific American had an article about hypnosis, and they gave a really good test for being able to tell whether you're hypnotizable or not, which, thanks to my faulty memory, I've completely forgotten.
But some people can be hypnotized more successfully than others.
Yeah, we had a case of a woman who was a GP, a highly intelligent woman, and she was hypnotized to send me a postcard every day. And she would make up all sorts of reasons why she had to write out a postcard and send me one, which she did for 3 weeks.
Wow.
Okay,
interesting stuff. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Brent.
Thanks.
And that's about all the time we have. Very interesting hour this hour, Dr. Carl. You can catch up on the big ground that we covered, broad ground we covered, on this Thursday morning on the podcast, as always, triplej.net.au. Just click on podcast, and if you missed any of it, you can catch up without the music. Just wall-to-wall science. See you next week.
See you, PGK.